That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. A post-Super Bowl gloating is necessary because I did pick the Eagles to win. I picked the Eagles throughout the postseason. And so I just need to take this opportunity to remind you all that I was right. You know, I do that so rarely, but I feel like now's the time. And I got to give a shout out to my sister Katie, who is a diehard Eagles fan. I'm not sure exactly when she abandoned our hometown Chicago Bears, but she got to Lehigh. They had training camp there, or she was dating a football player. For whatever reason, I can't remember the exact, or maybe it was a combination of things. She switched her allegiance to the Eagles, and it's finally paid off for her. And it paid off before my Bears fandom has. So congrats to her. I was rooting for them. There's a bunch of good guys on that team that make it easy to root for. And if you haven't yet heard Nick Foles' comments after the game about failure and how important it is to understand failure and not to hide it, not get caught up in social media and comparing yourself to the positive stuff people put out there and assume that they don't have stuff going on behind the scenes, you should definitely go find it and listen. It actually reminded me a bit of Kate Fagan's book, What Made Maddie Run. He was giving off some of those same good messages. So awesome stuff from Nick Foles. And also, if you haven't seen the live footage, the mic'd up footage of Nick Foles suggesting to Doug Peterson that they run the Philly special on that fourth down play just before the half, definitely watch that too, because it's pretty cool to see that relationship between quarterback and coach. Foles was already playing with such incredible confidence, but to see Peterson say, all right, let's do it, and have the balls on both of them to do that was pretty awesome to watch. Today's guest, we might talk a little Super Bowl, but I really want to get into his history because he's got such an interesting one. Chris Connolly, who's a reporter for ESPN, also works on E60 and does a lot of great feature stories for us. He was at one point the interim editor-in-chief of Grantland, has a really cool history at ESPN, but even before that, I think we all remember him being at MTV for a long time during that stretch when the MTV News folks were some of the biggest stars in our country, that the people that we went to for Rock of the Vote and the biggest interviews and gets. So his interest in both sports and the entertainment side of things is really cool. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview with Chris Connolly.
That's what she said.
So happy to be joined by my colleague Chris Connolly. He's an ESPN reporter whose stories appear on SC Featured and E60, among other places. Also a contributor to ABC News. You can see his stuff on Good Morning America, 2020, Nightline. He's got all sorts of awards, sports, Emmys, Edward R. Murrow Awards. I think you got a Peabody, too, right? Is that true?
I do have a Peabody. I think it was people who were very nice on 30 for 30, you know, asking me on their team. So,
well, we're both.
You know,
we're
it's a lot of track lighting. But really, it's worth it.
We're both in the Peabody camp, so we can brag to each other about that. And as they said at the awards last year that I was at, there are somebodies, there are nobodies, and then there are Peabodies. So
I think of myself more as a Mr. Peabody, like from the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I actually, you know, I had Tabitha Soren on the podcast a couple months ago, and I loved chatting with her. So you know I'm going to start by getting back into your MTV days. But before that, and way before that, and then I'll have to call up Kennedy and everybody else and make sure I get the whole crew. But before that, I want to start when you were a kid. You know, you are obviously an incredibly accomplished journalist. Were you a serious kid?
I on occasion I was serious. Maybe pompous is the word you're looking for.
Oh, okay.
Self-serious on occasion. but at some point I realized this was not really the way to go through life. And so one wanted also to entertain. And so I would kind of work both sides of the room, I guess. On occasion I would be, maybe it was the era, you know, it was the late 60s and the early 70s. It was kind of a serious time. I did want to try to make people laugh from time to time. When you get into the realm that we're in now, you realize the difference between being amusing, which I seek to be, and being genuinely funny, which a number of our colleagues really are. So
yeah,
exactly. I'm happy just to I'm content to be amusing and to stand in awe of those who are genuinely funny.
So were you already doing high school newspaper and stuff when you were growing up?
I did a little of that, yes. You know, you remember that movie where the kid joins every conceivable after school activity? That was probably me.
Right,
you know,
right.
Government and singing and acting and the baseball team and yes, the newspaper and all the rest of it. So So, yeah, if you could do it after school and it was somehow involved with school, I probably did it. Yes.
Okay, so you're a Renaissance kid. And at what point did you
jack of all trades, master of just
that's
a
my that's my things. Line, right? I even went on to do heptathlon, which is the sports version of jack of all trades, master of none. Because I was the same. Basketball, field hockey, track, clarinet, chorus, talent show, everything else.
Clarinet, people should realize, clarinet is a difficult instrument to play. It's significantly more difficult, correct me if I'm wrong, than the saxophone, because when you go up an octave, the fingering changes, doesn't it?
Well, actually, what's interesting about the saxophone and the clarinet is they have almost the exact same fingering. It's all about the embouchure, which is the shape of your mouth when you're playing. So if you can play one, it's actually really easy to transition over to the other. I never got into the saxophone, but I wish I had. I would like to, you know, be able to Kenny G it every once in a while.
As opposed to something like the oboe, which I once heard referred to as an ill wind that nobody blows good.
So. The oboe always looked really hard to me, and the flute. I was not meant to be a flautist. I just couldn't get it right. But
Because of how old I was, you had to learn how to play the guitar. Like you had to take the SATs and the achievements. So I was like the anchor man on the guitar team. I was like the worst guitarist of my generation. But you had to learn. There was no way around it.
So you become all of these things, you're an amateur everything as you're growing up.
Yes.
At what point did you decide to focus yourself and that you, was it in college that you already knew you wanted to be a journalist?
I'm not sure that ever happened. I thought I would be.
Why start now?
I don't know if you felt this way. I thought I would be the lawyer who knew, who knew who had won the 1960 NFL championship.
Okay.
I thought I'd be the
lawyer.
My whole
family's lawyers, so I never thought I would be the lawyer.
I thought I'd be the lawyer who knew who played bass on some obscure Bob Dylan song. And then at some point in college, I realized you might actually be able to make a living just knowing who played bass on a Bob Dylan song. And so I thought, why don't we give that a try for a while? And that's kind of what happened. And then I got a job through a classified ad. And I wound up as the receptionist at Rolling Stone magazine.
And that was in a classified ad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow,
I called up and said, yeah, I went to this college and I worked on the radio station and I worked on the paper and I have this journalism interest. And they interrupted me and said, you have a nice phone voice.
That's really funny. Okay, so you started your journalism career as the receptionist at Rolling Stone. How long did it take you to actually be contributing content?
I was ridiculously lucky, and perhaps the benefit of sexism, because I think as a boy receptionist, I think inherently people would look at me every day and say to themselves, he must want to do something else.
Right.
And I think if I was a woman, people might not have thought the same thing. So I got opportunities relatively early, it seemed like, and they made me Kurt Loder's assistant, reporting assistant 14 months later.
Wow.
So that was the beginning of 1981.
And then eventually you go on to write cover stories on Madonna, Tom Cruise, Sean Penn, U2. How long were you at Rolling Stone?
Through 1985.
Okay.
And then the guy who ran Rolling Stone. So, it was a great period for all those folks you mentioned. Those were all, in many cases, their first cover stories in national magazines. And so they were very interested in giving you great access and having you talk to their friends and their coworkers and stuff. So you really had the run of the field for a lot of these guys who would go on to great success later.
And you obviously cut your chops somewhere where there's a lot to lose. You know, some of us get to get started on a website that only has so many viewers or readers. You were on a big stage. Were there moments at Rolling Stone early on where you had major lessons to learn?
I am sad to admit that I was the writer of a column called Random Notes. And I wrote a story based on some pictures that we'd gotten of Bob Marley at an alternative cancer treatment center. And the story alleged, the information alleged that he was making some progress. And so I think I wrote a story that suggested that Bob Marley was waging his battle against cancer and might be having some success. And by the time we came out, Bob Marley had died. So that was the lesson in terms of being a lot less, credulous in terms of the information you got and making sure you didn't say anything that you didn't have a reasonable and backed suspicion that was true. But the important thing to remember is, as opposed to someone who would have been starting on a website or something, I had this amazing team at Rolling Stone right. working for me. You know, I had editors and copy editors and research people and stuff. So I was insulated from my normal penchant to make massive mistakes.
Right. And you didn't have social media to try to ruin your career.
Oh, my gosh. No, we didn't. No, we did not. So I wish everybody could have wish everyone under 25 the opportunity to make all the ups and downs and backs and forths, you know, they could in journalism without the scrutinizing eye of the world on them at every moment.
Yeah, it's really hard. So you were also a special music correspondent for Good Morning America back in the 80s. And
yes,
when did you
that was
start?
Your Hall & Oates, Peter Gabriel, Robert
nice.
Palmer.
Yes.
You know, that era, you know, so good times all the way around. A better time for music than,
I was gonna
than
say,
we might have realized at the time, you know?
You have such an interesting perspective because you have covered music, movies, and sports beginning in the 80s up till now, and those industries have all changed so drastically. So just, not just the covering of it, but, you know, how it's even digested by people.
Yeah, everything about it, you know, has transformed. I mean, if you think, like, 100 years ago, you made money in music on sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's as much as it's changed since 2000 even, you know. Everybody, you know, I began when they were still selling vinyl and was continuing when they did cassettes and moved on to CDs.
And
then the physical product went away and so did all the money. So,
right, well, now you're working when vinyl is back because it's retro. You've made
exactly,
the full circle.
Yes. Exactly, yes. You know, I'm the impossibly pretentious guy at Urban Outfitters going, oh, yeah, I've had that since 85.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I was on board way before.
And it sounds like somebody's making breakfast in the background of my Pearl Jam vinyl.
Yes,
I played it
exactly.
So much.
Exactly. I love that. So you end up at MTV in 88, and you're there for 13 or 14 years. And when you got
Which seems impossible, right?
It, right?
Like, there must have been 6 years there where they didn't even notice I was there.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I, of course, remember the years where you were one of the biggest stars of the time. It felt like the MTV News, at least the age that I was when that was going on, it felt like it was you and Kennedy and Tabitha Soren and Kurt Loder were teaching us about not just music but the news and life, and that was a focus point for so many people in pop culture, but that wasn't 13 or 14 years worth. So tell me sort of that journey at MTV.
Well, you know, you're nice to put me in the same category as someone like Tabitha and Kennedy, who really carried the standard of the channel during the years they were there. You know, I always felt like I, on occasion, like I was the chaperone at the high school dance at MTV. Because that was kind of what the news department did. Like, the news department just made sure every now and then things stayed between the lines. And when there was bad news, and sometimes there was, you know, we were able to kind of keep people centered and together on it a little bit so that people didn't really flip out. And then we were just kind of there as the hall monitors and things. But I began as the movie guy. I began as the movie equivalent of Kurt. They'd hired Kurt from Rolling Stone to talk to musical artists. And they hired me from a magazine called Premiere. In fact, I stayed at Premiere as an editor while I was at MTV. And I interviewed movie stars. And so I did that, and we had a show called The Big Picture that we did weekly until about the middle of the 90s. And then they got rid of Big Picture. We did some movie specials. And they remembered that I had done music in the past. And so I started doing music stuff and politics and all the rest of it. And so I guess I transitioned kind of in the middle 90s there to more general stuff and interacted more with Tabitha and people like that afterwards.
When you got there, was Kurt Loder already there? And was there any connection from having worked together at Rolling Stone as to how you got that gig?
I had the office next to him for 4 years, 4.5 years. We had a difficult day at Rolling Stone once. And I remember my editor, Jim Hankey, we were all in the office together. And Jim said, this is when we were Rolling Stone, there's got to be an easier way to make a living. And Kurt didn't even look up from the New York Times. He said, there isn't. I've tried. And then we wound up at MTV.
Yeah, that's funny.
So that's people there were super supportive. And so I would be interviewing, Julia Roberts and Kevin Costner and Kid and Play and guys like that. And Kurt would be talking to Madonna. So it all worked out pretty well.
Yeah. So you mentioned Premiere Magazine. You were there as an editor and reporter and eventually became editor-in-chief. But from what I read, the EIC gig didn't last long. Can you talk about the end of Premiere?
We had a you know, we had just gotten new ownership, and new ownership had some thoughts, and I had some thoughts that were slightly different, and so it was clear to me that we were not on the same page. So I moved on, and then
and how old were you then?
I was 39, and had just had our third kid.
So that's tough. That's a tough decision to make at that age and that time.
I mean, I did have the job at MTV, so I can't, you know, so it's right. Not like I was falling through a trapdoor. But yes, people were super supportive. It was a very stirring time, and it's good to see that good journalism is still being done out there about the entertainment world and other things.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So what are, you know, of the time at MTV, you did some of the pre-shows for MTV Awards. You at one point had a weekly show called The Big Picture. You, of course, you know, worked hand in hand with the MTV News stuff. What was one of the standout moments for you? Or was there a moment at MTV that maybe you thought to yourself, oh, my gosh, I'm doing it in a way that you hadn't felt before?
Well, the great thing, and I'm sure you feel this way about the stuff you do, is that the great thing about working at MTV, and it's the great thing about working at ESPN, it's the audience. It's the level of intelligence of the audience. Because it's such a specific audience, you could talk to people at MTV about popular culture, particularly about music, in a way that you'd have to explain a lot of stuff. They were really smart and knowledgeable about music.
Right.
And it's the same thing at ESPN. It's like, it's not like talking to a big, huge broadcast network. People who listen to you on ESPN, they know a lot of stuff. You can talk to them at a super high level. And that's the part I liked. If you were on the Warped Tour, if you were at Woodstock 94 or Woodstock 99 and you were interviewing the acts there or something, you could always speak to them on a level that was, you know, that was really high. And then occasionally crazy things happened. This is the 20th anniversary of Old Dirty Bastard from the Wu-Tang Clan coming on stage in the middle of Sean Colvin's acceptance speech at the Grammys and saying Wu-Tang is for the children. This is years before Kanye and Taylor Swift, right?
Yeah.
Came up on stage. And so who was assigned at the Grammys 20 years ago to interview ODB about what he had just done to Sean Colvin's speech? That was me. How did I ask the question? He said he felt it was important to get that message across. And I said, do you believe that was an appropriate way to make that point?
And his answer was?
I think he said Wu-Tang was for the children again. You got to stay on message. That's the important thing.
Right, you're right. He had his talking point. That was all he had.
That's right. You got to do it. We love them both, ODB and Sean Cole.
It's funny because those moments, I guess – We all remember even the Kanye Taylor Swift because it was such a big deal. But those moments are rarer and rarer now because our collective conscience is so spread out, right? There's this great book, and I'm going to forget the name, but it's basically a book that's supposed to give you all the references that you need. So when someone says the sinking of the Titanic, you know what it means. Or when someone says the Little House on the Prairie interruption, you know what that meant. It's so hard to do now because there's 1,000 shows and movies and books and podcasts. So when you're covering stuff back
and that's
then,
why our, and that's why our big events are still so important. You know, that's why, like, when we do the national championship game in college football, everyone's watching it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We can all talk about it. It's the, you know, and the Oscars are the same way. It's like, yeah, people say they don't. But, like, everybody watches the Oscars. You can talk about them forever. And these big, huge events in this incredibly atomized time are the things that kind of bring us together, you know. And that's the fun part. That's the kind of thing that allows, like, that wonderful story you did with the Gronk kid. You know, it's the kind of, because we all know Gronk and because we've all watched the Patriots, you get to do a beautiful story like that. And that's, you know, that's phenomenal as well.
Do you think it's, how different do you think it is to cover something like that then versus now? Is it just a matter of the number of eyeballs or how spread out attention spans are?
Well, the thing is, like I used to say at Premiere, it's like if we were going to do the story about a director changing on a Star Wars movie, we could report it and run it in our magazine. It would come out 6 weeks later and nobody would have heard about it.
Right.
And now people hear about it like within the hour. So even in terms of what we do, if we're covering an event, there are like 50,000 people out there who have really funny immediate takes on the Super Bowl or on Justin Timberlake's halftime show, like right away. So by the time you're doing them the night after, you really have to be clever. You really have to be on your game to just to have something interesting to say. And that means, for a lot of us, it means great reporting. And thank goodness we have such great reporters. And it means really making your takes super fresh and interesting and different, because with social media, people are there hours before the rest of us are.
Yeah, and so much of it is less just the reporting of it, but the opinion on it, right? Which has also changed the job of the reporter, because...
And that's the funny thing that happened to me, is that I was kind of paid for sort of my opinions, I guess, at MTV a lot, you know, and I certainly used the microphone a lot and talked as all kinds of stuff as I could. And then when I got to ESPN, I got a job where most of my job was listening, you know, was sitting across from somebody and saying, so what happened to you? And how did you feel about it? You know, I was talking to people in crisis a lot, or people who were recalling a crisis. And it wasn't about me so much or what I thought. It was really about them. And so I found, and I've found since coming to ESPN, much of my job is listening and sort of hearing people tell their stories. And that's been like a real revelation for me. People have amazing stories. Famous people and people who you would just... You would know had amazing stories to tell, and I'm grateful that ESPN has put me in the chair opposite them to enable me to hear those stories.
Yeah, it's a totally different feeling, too, when you're talking to a celebrity versus someone who is only talking to you because this is the moment in their life that has brought them attention, and oftentimes not for good reason. It's a it's a totally different task. All right, so you're at MTV to 2001, and as you mentioned, most of that time you're also working at Premiere and also doing some of the Academy Awards pre-show. So
correct,
you're really very deeply entrenched in the entertainment scene. What brings you to ESPN in 2001, and what was it about? Was there always an interest in sports throughout your time, even at Rolling Stone and MTV?
Yes, my line used to be that I love sports. I don't always like people who love sports.
Yes, hey, that's still my line. That
you
should
know what
be
it
my,
is?
That should be my bio.
If you looked at, you know, honestly, if you looked back in the 80s, okay, if you looked at the people who covered sports, who were in sports, and you looked at the people who covered entertainment and who were in entertainment, there was definitely a diversity difference. There was definitely a, you know, types of people, you know, were very different. And so I was drawn to, you know, entertainment and all the different kinds of people you get to hang out with a little bit, you know. But no, I always loved sports, you know, and John Walsh I had known since I was the receptionist, and he was a Rolling Stone alumnus, and we'd always been in conversations over the years, and he knew of my interest in sports, and I knew he had been the editor of Inside Sports, which was one of my favorite magazines. And so when the time was right, you know, it didn't seem like being at staying at MTV in your 40s was an intelligent idea, especially for the audience. And so so I came over to ESPN to host the show that was that is now taken by the you know, Around the Horn time slot. And so I always take some credit for the success of Around the Horn, because my ratings were so bad that when Around the Horn showed up, like, their ratings came through the roof compared to what they'd done a year before.
Yeah, people were just,
and that was totally
for
on me.
Good,
like,
right?
I had a great producer in Charlie Moynihan. I had great people on staff. I mean, they were looking out for me, and I must not have done a very good job.
What do you think?
Interesting how ESPN lets you, you know, not succeed, and then finds the thing that they think you know how to do.
Yeah. Why do you think? So that was the Unscripted with Chris Connolly.
That's
supposed
right.
to be sort of a contemporary version of the Up Close interview show that had been on the
correct.
On the network. Why don't you think it worked?
I think you'd have to start with me.
I mean, it can't really be.
Like
I mean, you're
say,
still in
really
the business after all these
really
years, so you've got something going
really
for
good,
you. It must.
Really good guess, you know? You might be able to make the case that half an hour of unedited conversation from athletes in 2001, you know, wasn't commercial gold, you know.
Right, ahead of its
time,
maybe.
Hearing people express their... I mean, our show started the same day as PTI. How has PTI done?
Right, pretty good. Still going.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's interesting, though, because I've always... Part of the reason that I started this podcast is because I really do like digging deep into people with process, like who they are, how they became that way, how they got to where they are, what they learned along the way. And I have to admit, there are some athletes that are fascinating to talk about that stuff with, but I tend to enjoy more people who are not the athletes, either the reporters or the comedians or the musicians. There's more of a depth to the process of and to how they view themselves in their lives.
Well, this is a question I get a fair amount. You know, it's like, what's it like interviewing entertainers and athletes? And my usual response is that athletes have to be hyper focused. You know, like we were I think social media today is a tribute to your athletic career, yes. If I'm not mistaken.
Girls and Women in Sports Day, yeah.
which we're very grateful to see. And you know, the elite athlete is super focused, no distraction, straight ahead, like just like zoned in. And entertainers, their job is human behavior. And their job is to observe other people and to write songs about them or movies or act in them and stuff. And so they have to have a different view of the world. So entertainers on some level are easier to talk to. What I would say about people in sports, though, and I'll bet you would agree, the stakes are much higher.
Yeah.
The stakes are higher. They win or they lose. There is no such thing as a critically acclaimed loss in the Super Bowl.
Right.
You know? You can have a critically acclaimed record or a movie that a movie that was a cult classic. There are no cult classics defeats.
Right. We call those moral victories, but we don't always buy it even when we do that. Yeah.
No, and they live and die with that. And if you suffer an injury or something, your life goes away. Like if George Clooney has a flop movie, they're going to give George another chance. If somebody hurts his knee in college, that's it.
It is.
And so that's a powerful thing, and it's a powerful way to tell stories. When so much is on the line, you know, when so much rides on something, the stakes are high, and that makes for good stories. And so in some cases, it's easier to tell more compelling stories about athletes than it is about entertainers because they risk so much every time they play.
Right. And I guess maybe in sports, the conversations are just more external than internal, right? It's about what they do and when and where and less about how they feel about it. Because sometimes that can be hard to access. Not for all of them. Sometimes that's what's so interesting. And I think our interest in the NBA right now so much stems from the fact that we're getting to see inside more than some of the other sports because there's so much beef. I call it Sweet Valley High NBA. And in some ways, it's annoying, but in other ways, it's so compelling.
You know, it's really true, though. It's like all the rules. You know, it's like that moment in the 90s when all those guys who had been in World War II realized that we really did want to know what they'd gone through.
Right.
They thought that by not telling us, they were sparing us. And we said, no, we really want to know now what your experience is like. And it was this huge revelation for them. They could finally say what they lived. The way that athletes now are talking about their relationships with referees, with coaches, with other players, is all the stuff that always happened, but they never talked about before. And we are really getting an education. Yeah. I mean, at least if you're a fan like me, we are really getting an education in stuff that we didn't understand much before. It's quite something.
I don't think the refs like it so much, how emboldened the players have become, but that's...
Well, it's time for the refs to start talking. I mean, this is the refs are acting like those, you know, like those guys who think, well, nobody wants to hear my story.
I think they might be contractually obligated not to speak. I think it might be in their contracts, unfortunately, which gives us the one
side of it. We got to fix that, right?
Yeah.
You know? We got to get ref podcasts and ref half hour shows.
We'll do the voice modulator,
with refs,
right?
And stuff. Can you imagine?
Yeah, look, we'll disguise their voices so that we know.
Of him? That kind of thing. Yeah.
So let's get back to your timeline. So you end up at ESPN, and Unscripted doesn't end up being what you want. And so immediately after that, which was only a couple months long, what was your feeling about that? Was it a fear of what's next, or what are they going to allow me to do after this failure? Were you on a pretty lengthy contract where you thought, oh, they're just going to
find
somebody else?
Given that I had three children, I mean, the thinking was always when I went, you know, go to a big place. Go to a place that will try to figure out what to do with you if the show doesn't work out. And so the show did not work out again because of me. and it was ironic because the show is called Unscripted. And I think somebody said, hey, you know what? I think he knows how to write.
Yeah.
And the truth was, this is so funny how things happen. Lisa Left Eye Lopez sadly died while I was doing Unscripted. And so because of Lisa Left Eye Lopez's relationship with Andre Rison, I was asked to write a kind of tribute to Left Eye for ESPN. And when I wrote it, I sort of wrote a little thing about athletes and entertainers and their romantic histories and all the rest of it. And I think somebody looked at it and said, oh, you know what? He can write a little bit. Why don't we find something for him to do where he can write? And I think they were just starting to really make a commitment to some of these emotion-based stories that people are now very familiar with. And so they gave me some great stories to start with. And I guess people liked them. And we kind of went from there. And now I think people very much associate ESPN with some of those pieces. And lots of people are doing amazing jobs with them. And, you know, Tom Rinaldi does just amazing work like every week with one of these pieces. And so I was lucky to get, you know, to get thought of to do some of those. And I think that's kind of what I'm probably most associated with at ESPN.
Yeah, that's your wheelhouse now. But you also at one point were tasked with taking over Grantland after Bill Simmons left. While the site was still alive, there was a time between Simmons' departure and the shuttering where they were attempting to keep it going. So you were the interim editor-in-chief. What was that experience like? Because that was so much associated with the man who kind of helped create it. What was it like to sort of take over those people who had been working for him maybe because they wanted to work
for him? I think it was a challenging situation for everybody. And especially for those people who were, you know, who were understandably extremely loyal to Bill. And so and extremely loyal to the site and to the quality of work. And I think it's a tribute to them that in the few months that we were still doing it, the quality of the work on the site was still outstanding, you know, even given the strong emotions they were surely feeling in the middle of all that. And I have to say, people were personally, you know, perfectly gracious to me, you know, whatever their feelings about what had gone on and all the rest of it, you know, they were all, you know, totally gracious to me as we moved forward. And not surprisingly, they all found work immediately after the site, you know, was shut down, and people continued to read them and enjoy their work as they should. So, and we've got Zach and Bill under our roof and doing, you know, unbelievable work, you know, groundbreaking, must-read stuff every time they file. And so I think really everybody, you know, whatever the Sturm und Drang of it, I think everybody had a pretty happy ending, for which I'm very grateful.
When you have free time and you want to be entertained, what do you go for more, sports or movies and music?
Sports. I have to say sports. I'm watching, you know, I used to say if they're wearing uniforms and they're not carrying weapons, I'm probably watching, you know.
And I know people like that. They'll turn on the TV and they'll be like, well, the only live thing on right now is a, you know, high school softball game or firemen versus police flag football. And they will watch that over anything else. That's how much they're just drawn to competition.
Yeah. And I like movies. I like old TV. I like all that stuff. But honestly, what, Kentucky, Tennessee last night, you know, there I was.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, maybe you shouldn't have dunked the ball that way. Maybe you should, you know.
It's funny.
You know, I think we just love to see people. I am always so impressed by people showing that grace under pressure. You know, I mean, we saw it in the Super Bowl, and you see it in any high school game. It's like somebody's on the foul line with 2 seconds left. Somebody has to execute. How do they even keep the ball in their hand? How do they keep the tennis racket, you know, from, you know. I just love to watch it. I get caught up in it. I root for people. And it still hasn't gotten old in any respect for me. I still really enjoy it.
And it's interesting. I think in sports, we acknowledge that very well. We understand the stakes. And in entertainment, we maybe don't quite as much understand that, not so much the nerves of, say, being the halftime performer at the Super Bowl or performing live on the Grammys, but the fact that their performance ends up being as much an athletic feat. You can't fall when you're dancing. You can't drop the mic if you're dancing with the mic like JT was. I don't know if we talk about that the same way in terms of like nailing it live in that moment. And it's very similar actually to sports.
You know, I was at the Oscar luncheon yesterday, or covering the Oscar luncheon. I talked to Timothy Chalamet, who's the youngest best actor nominee since the 1930s for his work in Call Me By Your Name. Also a really big French soccer fan, which I enjoyed talking to him about. You know, but he said, you know, you always dream about being nominated for an Oscar, but I thought this would happen in my 40s or 50s.
Yeah.
And he said, Laura Dern came up to me and said, you know, I was nominated for an Oscar when I was 22 also. And she said, I wish, looking back now, I had just focused on the joy and the excitement of being nominated than any stress or second guessing or something like that. That was her way of saying, just really enjoy this for what it is. Sometimes that's hard for performers. That was a great message for her to give him, and he was very grateful to have received it. So it speaks to the point you're talking about. It's people in the public eye, they doubt themselves sometimes, or they wonder if things are coming at the right time. And enjoying it is usually the way to go, savoring the moment.
Right. It could be like, as far as I know, I don't think Anna Paquin's been nominated again. So you never know if that's your one shot to
soak
it all in.
That's right. Yeah. But she won, didn't she? Didn't she win?
Yeah, she did. Won. And she was wearing a weird beret or something like that.
Yeah, they're not coming and taking that Oscar off her mantelpiece.
Right. She's got it.
She went on to True Blood, and she's
done some great stuff.
She was in Almost Famous too, wasn't she? She's a talented actor.
So. Yeah, she's done a lot of great stuff. I want to do a quick speed round because I was looking at some of the list of who you've interviewed. I don't want to read it aloud yet because I don't want to put something in your head. I want whatever comes to your mind. So let's do speed round. Favorite entertainment interview that you've ever done?
Jim Carrey for MTV. He would do anything and did. Over and over again when we interviewed each other, when I interviewed him on MTV. He was out of his mind in the best way possible. Crazy creative, always something different.
Do you still think he is? Because I think the way he's delivering his message now is troubling to me, but the message itself is so smart.
Well, entertainers lead complicated lives and go to challenging places sometimes. And
yeah.
So, you know, you always keep the light on in the window. That's my feeling. You always, you always think they have the chance to amaze and delight you, whatever they're going through at a particular moment. That's the way I like to look at it.
Sports interview ever?
I'd have to say J.J. Watt. I had the greatest time with J.J. Watt when we did him like a year or so ago. He was phenomenal. He was so funny. And then he was very powerful talking about the influence of his grandfather in his life and stuff like that and how much his family meant to him. And so to see all the good he's been able to do and all the great stuff is phenomenal. I like the fact that we had a Super Bowl where the halftime entertainer had taught the Walter Payton Man of the Year a touchdown dance.
Yes. Synergy.
I think that's a good place to be.
Well, and I don't buy when people don't like J.J. Watt because they think he's fake. I think he seems like he really is that guy. I don't think it seems like an act.
Well, you know, sometimes we get to see them in formats that we don't. Like, I remember seeing Rob Gronkowski accept a Best Comeback Player Award at the ESPYs. It's one of the best speeches I've ever seen at the ESPYs, but people don't talk about it. He got up there and he talked about what it's like to be injured.
Right.
He thanked his parents for being there for all of his surgeries. His whole family was there. He talked about running into Lindsey Vonn as they were coming in and out of surgeries and what that bond was like. And you thought to yourself, there's a whole world of these people we don't know about. It's like what you just talked about. The whole world of athletes while they're injured and rehabbing and doubting themselves and whatever they can come back. Maybe we don't pay enough attention to that because that's a huge part of their
life. We just wait for them to come back. Yeah. We don't think about all the work it takes to come back either. We just think about what's the date for their return.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Get on the field. When are you getting on the field? And these things are journeys for them. I mean, and they have emotions and setbacks and stuff. And just to hear him talk like that in such a heartfelt way about what his family had done for him, it changed my impression of him like forever.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, your least favorite interview in entertainment?
I remember Rodney Dangerfield, God rest his soul, saying to me on the phone, "How long you been doing this, kid?"
Do you think your questions were bad?
I guess he did.
I did also once,
I should mention this, get spat at by Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, well, he doesn't seem like a great guy, on the
Oscar, I'm
not surprised to hear that. Yeah.
You can find it on YouTube.
And if you're wondering why I said he's not a great guy, go ahead and Google his comments on Howard Stern about Roman Polanski and his relationship with Harvey Weinstein. Least favorite interview sports.
I will stand on Rodney. God bless him.
He didn't
think I knew what I was doing. Yeah.
Sometimes they're right.
Maybe he was right.
Yeah.
Maybe he was right. I don't know. We'll never know.
Yeah. All right. Your least favorite sports interview.
Oh, let's see. Jason Kendall walked out of the interview I was doing with him on Unscripted. I don't know if he didn't like my questions or something like that, or maybe he couldn't hear me. But it is an awkward moment when you're on live television and your subject walks out of frame.
Why? Was it a tough line of questioning?
No, it was not.
That is very strange. How did you feel?
It was a tough line of questioning.
Right. How did you feel?
I guess it just wasn't his day. It wasn't my day. I don't know. Anything like that happens sometime, it's like you're talking and they drift off. And
wow. That's
just going, wow. What you say to yourself is, and this has nothing to do with Jason Kendall, but you say to yourself, if somebody's going to walk out on your interview, I wish I'd earned it.
Yeah, right. I wish I'd said the thing that sends you storming
off. I will say that Nate Newton also once walked out of an interview that I did with him. Hmm. It was about his, we were talking about not just the Cowboys, but his extensive career as alleged marijuana entrepreneur. But he had been in the chair for 2 hours, so you can't really complain after a while if you're me.
You got a lot. Your dream entertainment interview.
Oh. Well, I always kind of say the next one, but, a lot of, I've never really interviewed Springsteen. I've never interviewed Paul McCartney. I did interview Paul McCartney on ESPN of all places.
There you go.
Bob Dylan maybe. And then, I don't know. I'm usually interested in the next person who's experiencing success and trying to come to terms with it,
Right.
Like I interviewed Julia Michaels the other day for the woman who wrote Issues and who writes all these great songs, and it fascinates me. I think getting people early in their careers when they're still figuring stuff out is really interesting, whether they're athletes or they're, or they're actors or musicians. Their lives are still, hard to make sense of in their heads, and it's fascinating to hear them try to do it. And the fortunate thing about my career is that I've been in a position to catch a number of people that way, Tom Cruise and Sean Penn and stuff like that, when they were just like 21 or 22. So to see what's happened with them is always really interesting to me.
Well, and you've also talked to a ton of people that are no longer with us, which is something that you can always sort of, Whitney Houston, Prince, Michael Jackson, George Michael, all sorts of people that no one will ever get the chance to ask questions to again, which is cool.
Yes, it was, I remember talking to Whitney Houston, and she was pregnant with Bobby Christina, and boy, if that story could get any sadder, I can't imagine how. Yeah. But, but she was pregnant, and she was 6 months pregnant, and we had big hot lights in those days, and I did a big interview with her, and just as we were about to leave, somebody said, somebody said you would do this promo for the United Negro College Fund. And you and I have been around with enough famous people to know that that's just the kind of circumstance where somebody jumps in and says, she can't do it, she's hot.
Right.
She's got to go. She sat right there and did that promo. She just knocked that thing out of the park. And I'm just sitting there going, wow, that's really impressive. That's well done. And so just makes all the terrible things that happened afterwards that much worse because –
Well,
she had so much promise and so much talent. Yeah.
Yeah. Your dream interview for sports?
Doesn't everybody just want to have 4 hours with Tiger Woods?
Oh no, I want Michael Jordan way before Tiger Woods.
Well, I would ask him the same question. Well, I guess it's not true. I guess they've moved on. The question I was always going to ask Michael Jordan was, "Who was the last person you said I love you to?" And really meant it. But I guess Michael's married now, right?
Yeah, he's married.
Michael's been remarried.
Yeah, so.
That was always the thing. Who do you truly love in this world? Because everybody wants you and everyone wants a piece of you and you go your own way.
Totally honest, that would be fascinating.
What would you want to know from Michael Jordan that you don't know?
Oh my God, so many things. You'd have to have him be a completely honest moment, and I don't think we'll get that. We might not get that until he does the Quincy Jones 85 years old skit where he's just like, I'm going to say everything I've ever thought and known. Here's who killed Kennedy. Here's who. I don't know if you read that, but wow.
I've seen the screaming highlights.
Right, exactly.
I wonder, will I be like that at I won't
the thing
be
is, you got to guess. You got to guess how long you're going to be around.
I sort of be saying, and you know who else couldn't play was that guy in
the Beatles, terrible musicians.
Yeah, that guy in Semisonic, he could never play.
You got to guess your age, basically, how long you're going to last, and then maybe 5 years before you're like, all right, here it comes, because I only got 5 years left to own up to everyone that I trash on my way out.
This is the important thing about having more than one child, because once you have two, they can talk about you, and once you have two and you're of a certain age, eventually they can talk about you in front of you.
Right.
What are we going to do with Pop?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, before I let you go, there's one more thing you have to do.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects it. Number one, the natural talent you wish you were gifted with.
I wish I could play guitar like Robbie Robertson of the band.
Number two,
I would like to be a better guitar player, yes.
Yeah,
that would have
like
been
to
a lot of fun.
Just be able to play it. I try to learn and I suck and then I give up for a while.
You know?
It's hard to learn things when you're older.
No, I don't think that's true. I think it's easier to learn things when you get older because you kind of know the drill. You and the phrase older do not really like work in the same sentence.
Well, I'm talking the difference between learning the clarinet and being willing to play Hot Cross Buns for 2 hours when you're learning. Whereas now I'm like, what? I can't play this Prince song immediately. I'm done.
What was the big go-to clarinet song? Was that like a Benny Goodman song of some kind?
That you're, I
like,
didn't
memories
know a lot of Benny
of
Goodman.
Or something like that you were supposed to be able to crush? Or you're supposed to just be able to play Tufts over and over again?
I believe there was a Mozart piece that was sort of like the thing that I played, but who can remember these things?
I it's still in your closet though, right? Tell me the clarinet is not still in your closet.
No, my parents ended up, they said, do you think you're going to play it? And I said no, and so I think we sold it or gave it away because it was pretty expensive. Sadly. Although I should pick one up just for a whirl, see what comes back to me.
Yeah, you never know. Those fingers, they just kind of magically move and
muscle memory.
Get the intonation right. Can happen. Can you read music?
Yeah, for sure. There's got to be a time.
Well, see,
playing on my radio show.
theme coming in and out. Yes, I've written my own theme now.
Exactly.
I just thought it was.
Exactly. Well, my co-host is a fiddle player,
I thought
so
more personalized
we're
on
to something.
If I've written my own theme.
Right.
I call it Sarah's Theme.
That's right.
Sketches from Spain.
Yes. Ode to sports radio. Number two, your desert island album. You can only have one.
Revolver by the Beatles.
Wow. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Bono. Why not?
Okay. Interesting, yeah.
It's fun to be a rock star, and it'd be fun to try to do good in the world.
Yeah.
On the level that he does.
Yeah, for sure. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
There was a moment when I was working for MTV when we were at the 25th anniversary of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I was riding around on a bicycle, and somebody thought I needed a helmet. And so somebody borrowed the motorcycle helmet of Ray Sharkey, who was this really tough actor back then. Ray Sharkey, big, scary, not big, but like really tough, street tough. And to end the bit where I was riding on the bicycle, I threw the helmet and the helmet broke.
Oh.
And I thought Ray Sharkey would kill me.
And yet
and
you're
even
here.
As you mentioned that little bolt of fear that I had
right.
when I saw that I had broken the visor of Ray Sharkey's motorcycle helmet jolted through me just for a second, almost Pavlovian.
That's funny.
So Ray Sharkey, God bless him, is no longer with us.
And he
but
spared
as you can
you.
See, he did not kill me that night.
Yes.
So
number five, your biggest failure.
There have been so many. I certainly wanted Unscripted to do well. Like I say, I had a great producer and I had a great staff. So I felt really bad for all the people who had such high hopes in me. That's what you feel bad. Feel bad that everybody worked so hard to make you
a
success.
Whole show. Yeah,
and you did not
you.
Succeed and you feel like this is my fault. And now all these people have to find new jobs and stuff.
Yeah.
So that comes to mind.
Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Curiosity. I'm just really curious. It's like whether it's a book or a magazine or the internet, I want to find out stuff.
Me too.
I want to know where you went to college or where you went to high school or what you know. I want to go into every interview, if I can, knowing something about you that you don't think I'll know.
Yeah.
And I'll try to make sure that you know that in the first 10 minutes.
Huh.
Just because I want you to look at me like someone who's genuinely interested.
Right.
And maybe a little surprising. So that if you're used to giving the same answer a lot of times, maybe I'm just letting you know that I would, you know, that I'm on to you a little bit. So that's what I try to do.
One, and I think for a lot of people like us, it extends beyond that. Like if I go on a wine tour or a brewery tour, as they start talking, I didn't know I was interested in how this happens. But now that you're telling me about it, I'm going to ask whatever question comes to mind. So my husband always makes fun of me, says, oh, here it comes, straight A student, like, you know, teacher's pet. And I'm like, it's not that. It's just, if this is how I'm spending my time, I'm going to learn. I'm going to leave and I'm going to know something. That's just the way it is.
Connoisseurship or expertise in any area is interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I like to soak it up. And it's the kind of thing you can always have a conversation about. Like if your subject's father is a, you know, is a corrections officer at a jail, you start talking to them about that and you learn all these things you didn't know. You know, people are fascinating when they're talking about something that they know well that they can explain. And I always look forward to those conversations.
Totally agree. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
My doing good in the world. You know, one always wants to be worthy of the many blessings that one has been given. And I, you know, I have had every advantage, you know, from my upbringing onward, and being worthy of it is the thing I think about the most.
Do you have something keeping you from doing that?
Well, it's all that work you mentioned. I suppose that's
right, true.
And then, you know, but is there ever really a good excuse? Probably not.
All right. Number eight, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Kind, smart, and amusing.
But not funny.
But not funny.
Exactly.
Exactly. Look at that callback. Very well done.
Nice. And finally, the bonus question, who would you recommend I have a conversation with for this podcast?
Oh, well, I've already recommended you talk to Tabitha because...
Yes. Right.
You know,
and that
because
conversation
you're
great.
You're very, you know, you're very in sync that way. And you've probably talked to Jeremy Schapp, right? Who's like, have
I
you
haven't
ever talked
had
to
him
Jeremy?
On the pod yet. I should, my Cornell buddy.
Exactly. I mean, I've heard so much about Cornell from him that, you know, I feel like I know, you know, all I knew when I met him about Cornell was Ed Marinaro.
Yeah.
And I could go on a little bit about
Heisman
Ed Marinaro.
Award winner and star of Sisters.
Oh, my God. Hello, Hill Street Blues.
Oh, well, that's before my time.
Television shows in the history of TV.
That's before my time. Sisters was my wheelhouse.
My God. That's like saying, like, Superstar. You know, like Battle of the Network Superstars was an Edmund. I know it was before your time, yeah. And that's important to insist on that. You know, don't let old people say, what's the matter with you? Don't you remember? So, but it's true. Jeremy is fascinating in so many ways. Two things that Jeremy knows about that I did not know. One thing in particular, Jeremy knows everything there is to know about the British royal family.
Interesting.
I would never have known that.
He
is a master of he's master of the Olympics and the master of the British royal family. And you think you know the Olympics. You think you know the British royal family. And then you talk to Jeremy and you do not.
Right. All right. Well, that's
so
it. Chap it is. That's
you know, you'll have a good time,
task.
I promise.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I love talking with you. So much more we could get into. I think there'll have to be a part two sometime soon.
Always happy to join you for conversation. Thank you so much for thinking of me.
That's what she said.
This week's That's What She Read is actually twofold. I have one that I really want to share with you guys, but as I say almost every week, I got to stop sharing these sort of more serious topics and send out some fun stuff. So I have one of those too, but I think this was just too good to pass up. Marie Claire and Esquire got together and over the course of a couple months have put together this incredible compilation and collaboration of some of the smartest people speaking out about what's next for the Me Too movement. And it's perspectives from men and women about what's already been said and what's to come next. You know, really interesting discussions of, you know, the idea of there's already pushback on perhaps men who are not worthy of criticism getting roped in, and how we try to balance that with the idea that we literally have hundreds of years of women not being believed. Men saying, you know, if it's not me doing it, why is it my problem? Should we only be looking at, you know, the power structures and people at the top, or should we also be having honest conversations about people who are not in as much power that are still practicing, you know, unhealthy habits or sexual harassment? And Gabrielle Union-Wade talking about being a woman of color and how that affects their treatment during Me Too. So it's a really powerful group of people, some that you've heard of and some that you haven't, all coming together to speak on different issues. I highly recommend it. You can find it on marieclaire.com, or I believe they probably also have it up on Esquire since it's a collab. But I really recommend it as you're kind of continuing to learn and educate yourself throughout this movement. But I did promise something fun. And the fun story is on Vulture, and it is an interview with Quincy Jones, the likes of which I don't know that you'll believe until you read it, because it sounds absurd to say that in this one interview, he slams the Beatles, talks about dating Ivanka Trump, yes, Quincy Jones in his 80s, dating Ivanka Trump, and tells us who shot Kennedy. I'm not making that up. It is a very strange, very interesting interview with a man who, it appears at his current age, has just decided, meh, I don't care anymore. I got 28 Grammys. I've got a 70-year career in the music industry, and I guess I don't really care what people think anymore. But he gets into Michael Jackson stuff, into Jimi Hendrix, you know, being too afraid to get on one of his records, on Cosby, on Trump, on Oprah, on, you know, current hip hop stars. It's really wide ranging. It's highly entertaining, and you will probably react to it the same way that I did, which is just to gasp at every turn. So check that out. It's on Vulture. It's an interview with Quincy Jones. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.